Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today. The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
At Popular Science, we report and write dozens of science and tech stories every week. And while a lot of the fun facts we stumble across make it into our articles, there are lots of other weird facts that we just keep around the office. So we figured, why not share those with you? Welcome to The Weirdest Thing I Learned This Week from the editors of Popular Science. I'm Rachel Feltman.
I'm Eleanor Cummins.
I'm Sophie Bushwick.
So, in case you weren't with us last week, we have a really cool announcement, which is that Weirdest Thing is going to be performed live at Caveat in New York City on Friday, September 14th at 6:30 p.m. You can already get tickets online and find more info on our Facebook and Twitter, and it's going to be super fun. We're going to have audience participation, games, prizes, uncensored, unedited weird facts. We might make Billy play the theme song on a toy piano. Who knows what'll happen? Anyway, we really hope you'll join us because it would be super weird to do it without you. So on The Weirdest Thing I Learned This Week, we start by each offering a little tease of some kind of factoid or story that we picked up while reporting, reading, writing, answering angry emails, what have you. And then we decide what we just absolutely have to hear more about first. Once we've all had time to spin our little science yarns, we reconvene and vote on what the weirdest thing we learned this week actually was. And of course, you can vote for your own favorite weirdest thing on Twitter or Facebook. So, Sophie, since it's your first time on Weirdest Thing.
I'm so excited to be here.
We're so excited to have you. And why don't you give us your tease?
My tease is that in the late 1700s, early 1800s, there was something known as laughing gas parties.
Ooh. Cool.
Sign me up. I shouldn't say that yet. Who knows what's coming?
I mean, to be fair, I think people also had laughing gas parties in more recent times, but this is the...
Now they're called whippets. Eleanor, what's your tease?
My tease is flutes of all kinds, some made of human bones.
Weird. That's the description of my album on iTunes. Okay, my tease is that once there was a man who really wanted us all to ride zebras.
It's beautiful.
Yeah.
I want laughing gas.
Yeah, let's start with laughing gas.
Oh boy, I thought you would never ask. My story starts with Humphrey Davy. He is born in Cornwall in the late 1700s, and he's, at the time, this was a very remote area. And when he was younger, he was sort of rebellious and adventurous, but when his father died, when he was about 16, he started getting a little more serious. He got really into poetry and chemistry, as you do.
Two dark paths.
About this time, it was a really exciting time for science. People were like, hey, maybe the world isn't made up of four elements. It's actually, there's other stuff going on. There was a lot of new ideas around. This was about when the chemist Lavoisier was active before he, you know, died in the French Revolution. So great time to get into chemistry. And one of the people that Davy befriended around this time was Gregory Watt, son of James Watt, the guy who invented the Watt steam engine and also the horsepower. Huh. And they would, you know, hang out and gather minerals and get really drunk together. You know, good times. And Gregory wrote his father about this brilliant young man. And his father told a guy named Thomas Beddoes, who's a doctor, and he was... Beddoes at the time was in his 30s, and Davy was about 20, but they started corresponding, and Davy would share some of his really forward-thinking ideas. Like, people knew that plants absorbed carbon dioxide and produced oxygen, and humans would, you know, take in oxygen and produce carbon dioxide, but Davy sort of propounded the idea that this created an equilibrium, which was the first time someone described the carbon cycle. So he's clearly really forward-thinking and brilliant, and Beddoes hires him to run his pneumatic institute. So Beddoes wanted to have this institute where he would use inhalable treatments for diseases like tuberculosis. So the idea was he would give free treatment to people who needed it, and also he'd get to try out, like, can inhaling gases help you? Makes sense. Beddoes had asthma, and so it sort of makes sense that he'd be interested in this line of research. So Davy takes the job and he starts, you know, administering gas to people. And he realizes really quickly that there's not, this isn't based on actual experiments or trials. Like, they would give these treatments to people with TB, but they'd also give it to people with venereal disease. And they would sell, like, do-it-yourself inhaling kits to rich people so they could breathe gas at home. So Davy is like, I need to do research on this. So in 1799, he sets up these gas inhaling experiments, and his first subject is himself. So this was not great. He started getting fainting fits. He'd get nausea. He almost died once from inhaling carbon monoxide. He would his throat.
Davy.
Oh, Davy. In some ways, he was doing breakthroughs. Like, he would be measuring his own lung capacity. He was making all this equipment so he could measure the amount that people were inhaling and exhaling. When it really got interesting was when he decided that the gas that had the best safety record was nitrous oxide, or N2O, which we know better today as laughing gas. He would make this gas by heating crystals of ammonium nitrate. He collects the gas in this bag made out of oiled silk. And he passes it through water to remove impurities, and then there would be a mouthpiece he could use to inhale it. And he took these detailed lab notes on his own experience as he was doing it. He'd have people taking his pulse, and he'd be writing down his own impressions. And it very quickly became clear that Davy just loved laughing gas.
Uh-oh.
Wow.
Yeah. So he says, this gas has raised my pulse, made me dance about the laboratory as a madman, and has kept my spirits in a glow ever since.
This is why they say don't get high on your own supply.
Yeah. He also, because remember, he's a poet, so of course he decides, I'm going to have some nitrous oxide and then write a poem about it.
Oh, no.
So he did. And it's really interesting, because a lot of it is just him describing his physical symptoms. So he'd say, yet is my cheek with rosy blushes warm, yet are my eyes with sparkling luster filled, yet is my mouth replete with murmuring sound, yet are my limbs with inward transport thrilled.
It's Shakespearean. That's great.
He wrote some decent poetry, but this isn't one of them. And he starts, at one point he was breathing gas up to 3 or 4 times a day. Sometimes when he's at home alone, sometimes he'd like go for a walk and then he'd, you know, come home and have a session with the gas. And the really frustrating thing, though, is that he recognized that if you breathe enough gas, you could lose consciousness and then be brought back to awareness very quickly. But he didn't make the connection that you could use this during surgery.
Mm.
And it wasn't until 1844 that laughing gas was actually used as an anesthetic in surgery. So at the time, people were just, like, getting cut open with no painkillers.
Right.
And it was really miserable. So it's really annoying that he didn't make that connection earlier. Anyway, I said there would be parties, so let's get to the parties.
Other than the party of one that was just Davy dancing around the lab.
Exactly. He had another breakthrough. He pioneered the blind experimental method. So he would test laughing gas on people, but he wouldn't tell them whether it was gas or regular air, and he wouldn't tell them the concentration of the gas they were inhaling. So he decided to start with his friends and the people who came into the clinic for free treatment. This is actually where he first ran into trouble, because some of the people he gives this gas to are women. Oh, my God. It's very, clutch your pearls, please, because there's rumors that this reduces their inhibitions. This makes them hysterical.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, and this is going to lead to trouble
ankles
later on. But some of the people he gives it to are other poets. Mm-hmm. So, for example, the poet Robert Southey was the, he would go on to become poet laureate, and he was friends with, like, Wordsworth and that group. And he said, such a gas had Davy discovered, the gaseous oxide. It has made me laugh and tingle in every toe and fingertip. Davy has actually invented a new pleasure for which language has no name. I am going for more this evening. It makes one strong and happy, so gloriously happy.
They are so addicted.
I love it.
Also, just like, was it so depressing to be a Victorian that...
This isn't even Victorian. Yes. These people, this is like Regency era. This is, yeah, like late 1700s, early 1800s. It's like a really exciting time for science, but also for science and the arts together. So there's a reason that there's this chemist being buddy-buddy with all these poets. There was like this huge overlap. You know, you'd go to a party and you'd have like a painter and a poet and a couple scientific scientists and, you know, a doctor all sitting at the table together talking about ideas. But I think that it just wasn't, other than alcohol and opium, which was not widely used, you know, there wasn't a lot of
I'm just imagining stuff. Like Fitzwilliam Darcy on Laughing Gas.
That would have been a different book.
That would be an amazing book. Why hasn't anyone written Pride and Prejudice and Laughing Gas? During this time, Davy is also testing it on animals. He's also trying things like having wine and then laughing gas see how that changes. Apparently, it reduced his hangover the next day. And he also tried a portable gas chamber. So he would, you know, go into this gas chamber and just, like, be completely surrounded by gas. And he said, "The sensations were superior to any I ever experienced, inconceivably pleasurable. I seemed to be a sublime being, newly created and superior to other mortals. I was indignant at what they said of me and stalked majestically out of the laboratory to inform Dr. Kinglake privately that nothing existed but thoughts."
Oh, no. How did that go over?
I don't know. I think Dr. Kinglake was used to him being, like, to this guy being super high all the time.
Go back to your laughing gas box.
Wow. Anyway, so yeah, there's the laughing gas is an amazing thing, and all the people who took it in, like, the early 1800s were just having a ball. But, like I said, there'd be trouble down the line. So Davy, again, he's been really pretty rigorous with his method, despite the fact that he's just taking a ton of laughing gas. So he publishes a book about his findings, and the reaction was mixed. So in the popular press, he was really attacked. If you look up laughing gas political cartoons, you'll see some drawings from the time of people's imagined version of what these parties were, and they're really disturbing.
Is it like the Reefer Madness of the Regency era?
It's basically the Reefer Madness of the Regency. Yeah, it is. I mean, because remember, he's giving it to women, so people implied that there was this sexual debauchery going on.
Oh my god, it was literally the Reefer Madness of the Regency era.
Yeah, amazing. Someone spread a rumor about this woman who got pregnant under the influence of the gas, and yeah, it was not great. But that didn't really end up damaging Davy's career. So he went on to isolate for the first time elements such as potassium, calcium, strontium, barium, magnesium, and boron. And he used electricity. He invented this much safer mining lamp called the Davy lamp. Mm-hmm. And he also helped, he had as an assistant Michael Faraday, who went on to become a famous physicist.
Wow, that's amazing.
Imagine what he would have done without the drugs. Yeah.
Can laughing gas in the quantities in which he was using it damage you in any way? Like,
yes. Okay. So at the time he's doing the experiments, other chemists were actually classifying it as a toxic gas. And you need a certain amount of oxygen, and anything that's going to deprive you of oxygen it can mess with you. And so, like, in more modern era, people, you know, have used laughing gas recreationally as well as, you know, in the dentist's office. And that can definitely, if you use it irresponsibly, it can be dangerous.
Right. Mm.
Like if you were to say, you know, build your own portable gas chamber. But also the fact that he was making it by heating these crystals, there was the potential for explosions if he let the reaction kind of get out of control. So he was lucky in some ways, but also Davy was pretty brilliant. He was... You know, he went on to make some really cool discoveries. So despite the fact that he loved drugs.
Did he ever kick the habit, or did it just, was it like into his coffin?
No, I think that, you know, the whole inhaling laughing gas 3 to 4 times a day, he didn't do that for like all of his life.
Okay.
You know, sometimes even during this period when he was experimenting really heavily with it, he would sometimes, you know, only do it a couple times a week.
How responsible.
Okay, well, we're going to take a quick break and then we'll be back with some more weird facts.
Okay, pals, you love the Weirdest Thing I Learned This Week podcast, and now you can also love it as a Facebook group. Share your strangest facts and read all about the offbeat and outlandish findings of other science lovers. We'll also be publishing some of the bonus info and ramblings that didn't make it into the final cut of the podcast. Just search for The Weirdest Thing on Facebook.
And we're back, and now we're going to go to Bone Flutes with Eleanor.
Hello. I was recently writing a story about sound design when it comes to, like, you know, products like our devices and gadgets, and how much work goes into, you know, every, like, bing and click and clack. And it got me kind of started on, like, the question of, like, the oldest instrument. And it was a very interesting rabbit hole to fall down. So the oldest instruments are all flutes, which I find really interesting. And they date back, the confirmed ones date back to about 43,000 years ago.
Wow.
They've all been mainly identified in Germany, which is like a method that archaeologists have used to sort of prove like human habitation in that area and sort of, you know, track our migration around the globe. And so they've come in all different kinds of materials. There are some that are made of bird bone, some made of mammoth ivory. One that has a special place in my heart that is contested is made of cave bear bone, vulture wings, you know, however you could get it. And I think it sort of makes sense that these are some of the earliest instruments. You know, the idea that, like, if you, like, suck the marrow out of a bone and you have, like, a little hollow, you know, tool and you can kind of carve holes into it, you've got an instrument pretty quickly.
Yeah.
And also you have a snack.
Perfect. A win-win. And so, you know, I was just really excited to kind of find out about that history. But then I was like, what's the weirdest instrument, you know, around? There is also a case, I found at least one case, where, you know, human femurs are part of ritual musical instrumentation. So I brought a photo of a kangling, which is a Tibetan trump. It's really made out of a femur.
Wow, that is just a whole dang femur.
Yeah, there's really nothing. It's exactly what you...
They didn't even, like, make it... Wow, yeah.
It's just a femur, like you have seen on, you know, your own x-rays, wherever you're looking at bones. It's just that with some jewels, you know, added to it. And then obviously, you know, you can play it. It's used in rituals and funerals. And so the idea is that you can use really anyone's femur, but that you would prefer, obviously, the femur of a criminal. Or the person, or someone who maybe died in a very violent way, or someone who is a respected teacher.
Which reminds me of our medical cannibalism episode. You always want a
I'm just
good,
here to talk about
death.
Bones. And them dry bones. So they were used in this particular ritual. I'm not really sure how to pronounce it, but like a Chod ritual. Which is where you are trying to kind of communicate your fearlessness to the spirit world. And so, obviously, there is nothing more fearless than taking the femur of a criminal and putting it to your lips and playing a tune. So I think it really gets the job done.
Yeah.
I've just been kind of like looking into the history of music, and it's really interesting to think about the theories of how these instruments sort of evolved. There's definitely a debate over what qualifies as an actual instrument, right? When we're looking at stuff from 43,000 years ago, there's a lot of disagreement about, like, what is actually intentionally made, you know, into a flute.
Right.
So, like I was saying, there's one that's made out of cave bear bone that is, it dates to roughly the same period we're talking about, you know, like 40,000 years ago. It's called the Divja Babe Flute, which is such a good name. And they have, you know, been able to actually reconstruct it, and you can listen to the music. And you guys, it is so spooky. I was telling our video producer, Tom, about how, like, I was listening to this, and I just had to tell somebody about how, like, freaked out I was. And he was like, that's exactly how you, like, bring an ancient curse, like, on your family, is, like, listening to a reconstructed prehistoric flute. So that is really contested, though, because they are sort of, like, unsure if the holes are, you know, were carved intentionally mm-hmm. or if they are something that can, like, maybe happen from gnawing, you know, on a bone. And similarly, it's like, are flutes really the first instrument we were using, the first way that we were sort of making music, or is it just something that has, you know, enough of an evidence of human intervention that we can sort of tie them, you know, historically right. to this process?
Have they found any, like, wooden instruments?
Not really, not from this period.
You Sorry. Would think it would probably be because they wouldn't have survived.
Right, because, like, that would make sense to me that they'd made something. I mean, bone is great and all, but I feel like wood is pretty easy to carve.
Yeah, definitely. And it's like, I mean, if we were, you know, sort of like when I think about what would be the first instrument, I can definitely see, like I said, like, you know, carving something out of a hollow bone to you know, like, play. But I would just, like, imagine that, like, you know, drums and keeping mm-hmm. a beat was really foundational. Yeah. But, like, you know, in that kind of a case, if we found sticks near rocks, we would never be like, oh, this is an instrument. And, you know, the sort of drums that we do have from, you know, the historical record, like, are also often made out of, like, you know, like, stretching animal, mm-hmm. like, skin and organs, like, over a kind of, like, bowl, right, to get that sensation, and whether or not those would survive, you know, for very long is an interesting kind of question. Mm-hmm. There's, like, a lot of debate over this. One question that people have is about, you know, how long humans have been, like, singing for, since that's sort of the most innate instrument, right, is our voice.
Right.
And so humans, our vocal range apparently crystallized about 530,000 years ago, which is interesting to think that this has been more or less what it's been like. But it's obviously unclear when singing really begins. We've noticed that at least a few primates seem to sort of exhibit like singing behavior, lemurs, tarsiers, and gibbons among them. And some people have noticed that these animals all are, like, monogamous maters. So there's a scientific theory that maybe sort of singing emerges from our, you know, trying to communicate and woo, you know, kind of permanent partners. Again, obviously contested, but an interesting sort of theory. Another idea I find really fascinating is that, you know, human babies don't really cling to their mothers the same way that a lot of, like, primate babies do, and that having sometimes to have to set your baby down resulted in, like, baby talk and kind of cooing to your baby and finding these other ways to soothe them while your hands were occupied, you know, making dinner or whatever.
Whatever ladies do.
Yeah, you know.
Carving bone flutes.
Carving bone flutes, exactly, for your really cool ABBA-style band. and so this is definitely, like, a very unresolved kind of issue, but it's interesting to see how people have been trying to put it, you know, the archaeological record to use, as well as, like, you know, in the case of the human voice, that's based off of looking at historical anatomical specimens and watching how our throat and skull, like, literally evolve to mm-hmm. give us the capacity for different kinds of sounds.
Yeah.
Neanderthals definitely play a really big role in this history, because a lot of the time it seems like we're just trying to demean them. When you read, like, about all of these flutes, it's always, and this proves that Neanderthals were not, like, creative enough to make their own flutes, and that this is definitely a mark of, like, you know, the human spirit here in this place. And that even extends to the idea of our vocal range. Neanderthals had a very different, like, throat bone composition. And so people have recently been working on trying to recreate the sounds that Neanderthals make. You can Google this and find these very funny videos of voice actors being coached into a Neanderthal kind of physical position so that they can sort of mimic that. And then going super high-pitched. Like, you would never think that a Neanderthal is screaming, like, you know, like, at this, like, almost dog whistle kind of an octave, but that's exactly what they're doing. It's, like, very angry, and, you know, their shoulders, like, up to their ears, and then just this, like, really upsetting kind of baby-like whine emerging from, based off of these reconstructions we've done of their throats. This is just sort of, you know, what we're trying to piece together. And it sort of seems like unless we get time machine sometime soon, like, we'll never really know a lot of answers to these questions. But it is interesting, I thought, to just sort of put into context some of the more recent instruments that we have developed. I found these to be really surprising. When do you guys think that the saxophone was developed?
The saxophone?
Adolf Sachs developed that, right?
My goodness.
So, no, I know his name, but I don't know when. I think he was German. So that makes me think that it predates, like, just the jazz era. So...
But I wouldn't be surprised if it was, like, a 20th century instrument. Maybe 19th century, but not before then.
I vote 19th century.
Yeah, you guys are, like, musical detectives. like, 1840, Adolf Sachs, nailed it. Okay, what about a trumpet?
Oh, though that's, you know, you got your heralds. So,
oh yeah,
exactly.
So I don't know, when was heraldry invented?
What's that, like medieval? I think of like medieval castles, like a bunch of people outside with the long skinny trumpets.
I would say medieval-ish.
Yeah. So this is really interesting. In like 1500 BC, this is sort of similar to like the laughing gas of people not really putting together all of the potential of the device that they have. In like at least as long ago as 1500 BC, the ancient Greeks and Egyptians were using trumpets in battle as sort of like a rallying cry or to like organize the troops. But it wasn't until the medieval period, really like in the 1300s, that people were like, this is a musical instrument that we can use in other contexts. Okay, so then here's my last one that you guys are just going to make me feel like a fool. You'll probably get it down to the day. When was the piano developed?
Oh, right, because this is like a trick one because there's so much, quote, piano music that's from an era where pianos didn't actually exist yet.
For like clavichord and harpsichord and stuff?
Yeah, I want to say that the piano was invented in like the 1800s. 1800s?
I mean...
Definitely not before then.
If
the last millennium.
If harpsichords and stuff don't count as pianos, then... Or do they?
I'm not considering that. I'm considering, like, exactly what we would imagine. Yes, exactly.
Pianoforte. That sounds very, like, Little Women-y. So I'm just going to say 1800s.
So Bartolomeo Cristofori, an Italian... genius. he invented the piano as we know it today in 1700 or thereabouts.
So 1800, 1700, 1600. You know? I was right there.
I'm pretty glad that overall we're not using a lot of human bone-based instrumentation these days. But it was just really cool to sort of piece together this puzzle that, you know, like hundreds of archaeologists and music nerds are working through about how we did all these things that we do.
Such great flute facts.
Thank you.
We're going to take a quick break and then we'll be back with some not flute facts.
It's really easy to get confused by all of the tech news flying around the internet. On Last Week in Tech, the Popular Science tech team explains everything and tells you how all of these stories affect your daily life. New episodes post every Monday on Apple Podcasts, Google Play Music, SoundCloud, and pretty much anywhere else you can listen to podcasts. We'll talk to you then.
And we're back, and I'm going to talk about animal domestication. So we had a story up this week about domesticated foxes, which everybody loves, as evidenced by the long tail success of a PopSci.com article called "Can I Have a Pet Fox?" I know what you people want, and it's a pet fox. So this recent article was looking at a new study about this famous fox domestication experiment, which started in 1959 in the former Soviet Union. Basically, this guy decided to start breeding the most docile and human-friendly foxes that he could find. Does this again and again, generation after generation. At this point, we're about 40 generations out, and they act like puppies, and it's adorable. They're, you know, fully domesticated. They love playing with humans. They're cuddly. They're not going to bite your face off. They've even developed these different coat patterns, floppier ears, and like curly tails, which are totally unknown in wild foxes. That's something called domestication syndrome, as described by Charles Darwin, which is when you domesticate a mammal, it tends to develop like white patches, more infantile faces, and floppy ears. It literally gets cuter, even if you're not selecting for that. So with these foxes, you know, the way they domesticated them, which is the way you domesticate anything, is that they just pick the ones that played best with humans, you know, best served the purposes they wanted them to serve, and kept breeding for those traits. Looks weren't supposed to have anything to do with it, But there is this connection we don't quite understand yet between docility and these kind of cute features.
So maybe it's that, like, humans developed to find cute the traits that belonged to less harmful animals?
Right, or there might be something that, like, you're more... because you're more likely to survive as a docile animal if you're adorable.
Oh, yeah.
To, like, other species. Like, we really don't understand a lot. In fact, this recent study was trying to look at dogs and, like, a bunch of different kinds of wolves, including the domesticated wolves, to try to pick out what gene types were changing as the domestication happened. And they did find some, like, promising leads, but it was still a very confusing mishmash of, like, what genes seem to change when you domesticate an animal. These foxes are a great example of the difference between domesticating an animal and taming one. Because a lot of the foxes you can buy are tame, which really means nothing except that they're not a particularly aggressive baby fox. Like, right. If someone sells you a tame fox, it just means this particular baby fox probably will not bite your face off.
Emphasis on probably.
Right. And you can tame any animal, in theory, by just raising them to behave and follow human rules. And that animal, you know, may be a loose cannon. You know, there have been cases of people with wild animals that they thought were tame as pets attacking them because those instincts are still there. Or, you know, it's totally possible that that animal you tame will, you know, be chill for its entire life. But if that animal had a baby and was raised under a different set of rules, it would have totally lost all of the tameness because it is just behavioral conditioning. It has nothing to do with the, you know, genes of the animal. Domestication is when you do that taming generation after generation and specifically select for animals that are innately suited to your purposes.
So that's like every litter of every generation, you're picking the ones that are best to keep breeding.
Yes.
According to your purposes. And then you, yes. If you just do that for a long enough time, you're actually starting to affect change in the in your like micro population.
Right.
Kind of. Okay.
Yeah.
And that's the point where they start getting the curly, the floppy ears and everything.
Yeah, exactly. After many generations, you know, that kind of underlying tenets of what kind of animal can be domesticated. Traditionally, it was, I'm pretty sure this came from Darwin. He said the animal needs to have a desire for comfort. They need to be easy to tend, and they need to be useful and show a fondness for man. In Jared Diamond's book, Guns, Germs, and Steel, he actually expanded that to 6 criteria. He said they cannot be picky eaters because they need to be able to survive on, like, whatever food the humans are able to provide for them. They must reach maturity quickly relative to human lifespan because
right.
If it takes you a long time to even raise and tame one generation, you're not going to bother to keep doing it. They have to be able to breed in captivity, like unlike pandas, for example, which do a great job having sex in the wild. Terrible at doing it in zoos. They must be docile by nature. They cannot have a strong tendency to panic and flee. And they usually need to conform to social hierarchy so that they can recognize a human as a master.
Wow.
Cats are a notable exception.
I was going to say, that doesn't sound familiar for cats.
Right, exactly.
How long did it take for the 40 generations of these foxes to be bred? Like, was that one in one man's lifespan?
So this was since 1959.
Okay.
And they've just about hit, like, 40 now. So, yeah, foxes were great because they're closely related to dogs. You know, they're in the same genus. You can find individuals that are quite tameable. So that's really what it takes. That brings me to my next question, which is whether we could domesticate any animal. And of course, for all the reasons I've just outlined, we can't. There are animals that are simply, it would take too much work to wrestle that, like, those first generations. It would take too long. So maybe theoretically it's possible for any animal, but, like, gosh, would not be worth the trouble. And one that comes up a lot is the question of whether we could domesticate zebras or why we haven't. Because horses have, like, their history of domestication is pretty ancient. Not as ancient as the dog. There seems to be something pretty special about dogs that they have, like, a lot of genetic plasticity and just happen to have a lot of traits that made them very, like, simpatico with humans. So it was kind of primed to happen. But after dogs, like, you know, horses are one of the older ones, and you know, there were wild horses that people started to ride around Eurasia and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And the rest is history. We have some articles about it on popsci.com. A lot of people ask, you know, why didn't the same thing happen on the African continent with zebras? The answer is that zebras are real nasty sons of relative to wild horses even. And that's probably because the abundance of large natural predators there, like large, fast predators, you know, you have to imagine like what kinds of predators a horse in Eurasia was running away from versus like a cheetah. Mm-hmm. And so they had to become pretty like twitchy and fast animals. A zebra's kick can break a lion's jaw.
Whoa.
And they have very powerful, like, ducking reflexes to dodge predators as well, so they're pretty difficult to lasso. Hmm. And they are just temperamental. They don't want to hang out with humans at all. So they're an example of, you know, an animal where you would have a hard time wrangling them for long enough to produce enough generations to make a truly domesticated zebra. People have tamed zebras, but you know, those are going to be like one-offs. And there was once a man who was pretty into the idea. His name was Lionel Walter Rothschild, second Baron Rothschild of Tring. His father was actually the first Jewish member of the House of Lords not to have previously converted to Christianity. Seems like they were a pretty cool family. He was born in 1868 and loved zoology. Little Lionel, at the age of 7, declared that he would run a zoological museum. And he started his first in a garden shed at the age of 10. He worked at the family bank, but hated it. He seems like he was a real precious babby. He was 6'3", had some kind of speech impediment. He was described as, quote, rolling around like a grand piano on casters because he had very dainty feet, wait, even though he was so large.
Wait, a grand piano on casters was the metaphor they chose?
Yes.
We have lost our facility with language. I think this was
from a niece of his, perhaps. Lionel, possibly my new love. but he started working at the family bank around his 21st birthday, and he hated it. And his parents, who felt very guilty, I guess, also at the same time, gave him some land and built some cottages to house his books and insect collections. And then a much larger building behind it, they were like, here's your zoological museum. Now please go try to work at the bank. He did that until he was 40. And when he was, you know, 40, flirty, and thriving, as they say, he set out to finally go be a zoologist and, you know, just go find animal specimens.
Fulfill his dreams.
One fun fact, he actually sold off his beloved bird collection to the Museum of Natural History in New York City for only $200,000, even though it was likely worth a couple million.
Whoa.
And they found out later it was to get fast cash to pay off one of his three angry mistresses. Lionel never married. So the reason I bring up Lionel, other than all of that wonderful information I learned about him along the way, is that he strongly believed zebras could and should be tamed for riding. So he had a bunch of them from his private zoo trained for carriage pulling. No word on how many they had to try to train to actually get a few that would do it, but they did, you know, again, you can tame a zebra. They're just not domesticated. And he once drove four of them through Piccadilly to Buckingham Palace. And I have a picture of that, which we'll also have on popsci.com.
Ooh, that's a good look.
There he is.
I guess the motivation.
He wanted it. Yeah. It's so stylish. So, and he also had a single zebra cart to show off at home. A little less ostentatious than the four zebras. And he also liked riding around on his giant tortoise with, like, lettuce in front of it as to guide it.
Now which is rude. How fast could he
go? Don't sit on a giant tortoise. That's very rude, especially if you're a 6'3" man, no matter how dainty your feet are. But he really, like, wanted to share his love of these megafauna, and he didn't understand why we weren't, like, introducing them more into our daily lives. So really interesting guy, and just loved animals so much. Animals are fascinating, domestication fascinating. And it's really interesting to think about how much pressure we've put on specific species to turn them into animals that are useful to us. And I find it heartening to be reminded that there are many animals that we have absolutely no hope of doing so to.
Long live the zebra.
Yeah. So anyway, what was the weirdest thing we learned this week?
Laughing, yes.
Yeah. I'm with you on that one. The Regency era Reefer Madness laughing gas is pretty delightful.
Okay, I kind of like Lionel riding around on the tortoise, but if you're going to hand it to me, I'll take it.
Competition, but yeah. Laughing gas is amazing, and don't do it recreationally, kids.
There's a lot of stuff in this episode that you should not attempt.
Yeah.
Like opium. Making a flute out of someone's femur. Don't do that.
Ill-advised.
Laughing gas recreationally. Not even once. Gateway drug. And, yeah, domesticating a zebra. Also rude.
Weirdest thing. Don't try this at home.
The Weirdest Thing I Learned This Week is a Popular Science podcast. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play Music, SoundCloud, or wherever you're listening right now. And if you like the show, please rate and review us on iTunes. It helps other weirdos find the show. You can buy our merch, including Weirdest Thing t-shirts, tote bags, and mugs at popsci.threadless.com. Our theme music was produced by Billy Cadden. Our editor is Jason Letterman. If you have questions, suggestions, or weird stories to share, tweet us at weirdest_thing. Thanks for listening, weirdos.
Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well.
I absolutely love this because, you know, if you own a home, it can be really hard to maintain. It's hard to find people that can help you for a big project or a small. Well, whether it's in everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality, it can be hard just to know where to start. But now all you need to do is Angie that and find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Angie has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish. Or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps. Because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's ANGI.com.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.